This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Genocide Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host today, Jeff Bachman, a senior lecturer at the American University School of International Service. Thank you all for listening. Today, I'll be talking to Randall DeFalco about his book, Invisible Atrocities, The Aesthetic Biases of International Criminal Justice, published by Cambridge University Press in March of 2022. Randall, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks for joining me. And can you start us off by telling our listeners a bit about yourself?
So I am a legal scholar by training. I research atrocity, international criminal law, and I've done a fair amount of work, including field work in Cambodia, looking at kind of post-atrocity justice seeking there. And I'm currently an assistant professor of law at the University of Hawaii at Manoa's William S. Richardson School of Law.
Great. Thanks for sharing that with us. And I was going to save this question till the end, but I kind of want to kind of go with the flow here. You talked about your law background. So I'm going to start off with a big question. What utility does the law have, especially considering what you talk about in your book?
I think that is a big question, and it's one that I'm often grappling with. I think it depends on whether or not first we're speaking about kind of what kind of law, right? Criminal law is the focus of just kind of what I've mostly researched, international criminal law, versus any other array of kind of legal mechanisms that could be used as kind of components of redress or prevention even of atrocity violence and things like that. So when it comes to international criminal law, I vacillate on this a lot. I'm increasingly skeptical of its utility. I think that it could have some utility, but I think that that is marginal. And I think whatever marginal utility it has is constantly at risk of being kind of evacuated through the process of it kind of taking up all of the space, right? Like it's, I think it's of at best limited utility, but is treated as the first, best, and even worse, often sole response in the wake of mass atrocities. And I think that it can do some things in a limited way to some people and for some people at best. And yet it's often treated as kind of the best and perhaps only appropriate response. So I'm in the strange position of being a person who all of my training is in law, but I'm pretty skeptical about its utility.
My doctor was interdisciplinary, and I took classes at the law school, including international human rights law. But when I teach my course on the politics of genocide, We spend a lot of time talking about how politics has influenced, you know, the shaping of the wall, the development, the future developments after, say, the Genocide Convention, the politics of naming and recognition and so on. And so the wall starts to feel like a tool more than an instrument. I don't know if that really makes sense, but seems like more something that states use, especially the more powerful states. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but I also wanted to ask you, because you talk about Cambodia in your book, and I recently interviewed Alex Hinton about his book, The Anthropological Witness, and I was wondering, did the wall serve a purpose in the ECCC? Are there things that, is there evidence from that international criminal law can have good outcomes? Sorry, I'm rambling a bit, but what are your thoughts on any of that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to unpack there, and I'm familiar with some, but I confess not all of Alex's work, being the kind of sprawling universe that his work is, especially in relation to Cambodia. And I think, you know, with the tribunal having wound down, being essentially completely finished now, I think it leaves a lot of questions still open. And in terms of what the tribunal has accomplished, when I've had discussions with kind of other folks in the area of transitional justice and human rights who study Cambodia, it seems that the one thing that comes up the most in terms of a kind of positive contribution to contemporary Cambodia and post-atrocity justice seeking that the tribunal may have done was just getting people talking about that history, because it had been a kind of taboo subject and an often not even taught in schools and just something people didn't talk about, and that being a useful thing. Now, could that have happened without, you know, the hundreds of millions of dollars of expenditure, the years, what I think of as a very corrosive effect on the rule of law in terms of the example the tribunal set for Cambodia, with all of the extra legal, very dubious decision making that it demonstrated to the Cambodian population? I think probably yes. And I think lots of organizations have been trying to do that work, but they didn't have the kind of platform that came with, you know, a United Nations hybrid tribunal and the kind of international effort and resources put into the court. So I think it did do some things, I think that it was not only positives. I think there's costs involved, and not just the cost of money, right? I think it's a very mixed bag. And I think that it is likely to be one of the tribunals, kind of like the special panels in East Timor, increasingly like the special court for Sierra Leone, that are kind of just buried with the focus being on the ICC and then before that Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia as the kind of exemplars of international criminal justice. Not Thanks sure if that answered your question.
It did. And I, you know, now that we have that, we can take a step back and, the audience at this point doesn't really know just what your book is about yet. So let's start with the cover design. I like to start with the cover. I really like the cover of your book. And can you kind of describe it for the audience and connect it to the title and the content of your book? And also, were you an active participant in that design?
Sure. I'm happy to talk about it. So I'm very pleased with it as well. This is a book that I'm very happy to be judged by its cover. So I was very involved in the cover. I think it'll be clear why I was very concerned. Considering I'm talking about aesthetics, I knew people were going to be looking at it intensely. And also that, you know, as I'm sure we'll discuss, I'm a big critic of what I think is this kind of dominant atrocity aesthetic. And when I started looking for images that I could get licenses to put on the front of the book, most of them were just reproductions of the very aesthetic that I was critiquing as being kind of overarching and dominating and obscuring everything else when it comes to atrocity. So, you know, images that were suggested at various times were, you know, piles of literal piles of skulls, razor wire, bullets, bones, those kinds of things, right? Very visceral imagery. And I was deciding, you know, with also my incredibly limited budget of $0 for book cover imagery, I was trying to find something else. And eventually I came across this piece that just really struck me. And it is, so I'll describe it a little bit for the readers. It's a piece, it's an untitled piece by an artist who's a Holocaust survivor named Seja Stoika. I'm probably massacring her name. I'm sorry for that. The front of the piece, which is what features on the cover of the book, it depicts the eyes of people in hiding. And if you have to kind of look close to see the eyes, and it's very colorful. The back of the piece, which doesn't feature on the book, includes text and other imagery. So it's a two-sided piece of art. I think it's on canvas. I haven't seen the original. Among the texts are names of family members, expressions of fear of Nazi terror, as well as, perhaps most importantly for me, anxieties about food, expressions of anxieties about food. So the first lines of the text that are especially relevant to the themes of the book that appear on the back read, and this is translated by the Seja Stoika Foundation. Her family owns the piece, and I was very fortunate that the foundation consulted with the family, and they were very happy for me to use it. And so it reads, Auschwitz, a place without fruit. Dear God, where's the bread and sausage? Bread and sausage, sausage being in all caps. There was none of that in Auschwitz. So for me, both the image of the people hiding, of hiddenness and obscured visibility itself, right, along with the text's focus on the lack of food, really help crystallize and represent the interconnectedness of various forms of oppression and violence, from the spectacular to the everyday that I try to explore in the book. And then combined with the kind of striking image of obscured faces, which are hiding yet recognizable if we look closely, this emphasis on everyday experiences of atrocity and violence, kind of when she's talking about the lack of food, encapsulates much of what I've tried to convey, which is that if we are only able to look more carefully, maybe free from our aestheticize and other preconceptions regarding what atrocity crimes are, we may see certain overlooked forms of violence and oppression as atrocities, that is, as potential international crimes. So Stoika herself was a survivor of perhaps, of course, the most paradigmatic atrocity of all, Nazi concentration camps and the genocide. But she was a Roma woman, right? So, and as a Roma woman, she was a member of a largely overlooked class of victims. And so to me, the backgrounding of certain atrocities underscores the fact that as individuals and societies, we choose what we see and how we interpret and prioritize harm and suffering. The book focuses on a subset of other atrocity crimes that have remained largely obscured. And the ones I look at are those committed through means lacking the kind of dramatic spectacles of violence that are currently, I think, and I argue, associated with dominant social and legal understandings of atrocity and international crime.
Thanks, Randall. And so as long as we're on that, you mentioned you know, what the focus is, but what are some examples of invisible atrocities? This could be within cases, other broader human rights violations. What are some examples? And then, you know, you also talked about this already a little bit just now, but just for the audience, can you define the atrocity aesthetic?
Yeah, sure. So maybe I think the easiest way to explain that is kind of how I came to writing the book, because I didn't really set out thinking about aesthetics. So this kind of goes back to my days as a law student, and I was really interested in international law, human rights, atrocity and redress, these kind of big questions of global justice and international justice when I was in law school. And I was very fortunate to get some funding, and I spent a summer in law school in Cambodia working with the Documentation Center of Cambodia, which many readers, listeners, would be familiar with if they know anything about Cambodia. It's an organization that is local. It's a Cambodian-staffed organization that started out of a fund at Yale, but is now all in Cambodia. And they document the history of both the Khmer Rouge history, but also kind of more generally Cambodia's history of atrocity and oppression, with a special focus on the Khmer Rouge history from 1975 to 79. But they also kind of do transitional justice work, outreach. They work with victims, both perpetrators and survivors, and, you know, perpetrator victims, all those messy categories that bleed into one another. And so it's a kind of long-winded way of saying how I came to this is I was there, and one of my roles, and I went back. I was pretty fortunate after I graduated to get a Fulbright to go back. And I went back specifically to research famine, the famine that occurred under the Khmer Rouge, and how that might figure into legal forms of justice seeking, including those that might occur at the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia, also known as the Khmer Rouge Tribunal that we kind of discussed earlier. And so the reason I was really interested in this was because at other times I was involved in kind of grassroots outreach activities, where the center would have these kind of forums that were often very far deep in the countryside. And I just went to kind of watch, write the report. But also my other role would be to answer questions about the court, because I had read a lot about it. And the question I was asked very, very often was, will it being the court, prosecute them, being former Khmer Rouge officials and leaders and suspects, for starving us, for overworking us, for separating us from our families? And it was very clear, and then I had lots of discussions with my colleagues about exactly what was meant by this, but that this was an experience that at least the survivors experienced as a crime, as something perpetrated actively against them. And it was amazingly at the forefront of many people's mind, including people who had been put in jail, people who had been beaten, that this was the main question. And I thought at the time, probably not, but I didn't really know why. It was was it a question of feasibility? You know, is there a lack of law, lack of evidence? Is it a question of willpower? Is it a question of what is it a question of? And so doing graduate work, first a master's and then a doctorate, it kind of led me to the why question. And that's what led me to aesthetics, because I spent a lot of time convincing myself that there was sufficient law to at least address components of this. I wrote some stuff about crimes against humanity, specifically those of extermination, persecution, and other inhumane acts as a kind of tripartite possible avenue for seeking accountability for this famine, which was very directly caused and, in my view, perpetrated. And I was satisfied both by looking through available evidence in the form of like memos, Khmer Rouge era memos about rice transfers and secondary sources, and looking at the law, that this appeared feasible and that the culpability involved was, in my view, often more direct for the senior leaders than it was for some of the killings locally at kind of smaller local prisons and things like that, right? Where local officials had a lot of discretion in who they chose to, you know, abuse and kill. And so I was presenting that and thinking about it, and I was always kind of getting this question of like, yeah, but that's not really what it's about, right? That's not really what international criminal law is about. It's not what it does. That's not really an international crime. And I was wondering why, why? So then that's what led me to thinking about, and it was kind of aha, like it just doesn't look right, was the kind of simpler version of these often very convoluted questions I was asked. It doesn't look like what we're used to. It's not what we do. And then so I thought, well, what does an international crime, you know, colloquially an atrocity, look like? And that's what led to me looking at that and the atrocity aesthetic. And so I did a bunch of reading, as we do. I did some thinking and talking, especially with my colleagues at DC CAM and some of my colleagues at the University of Toronto, where I was doing my graduate work, and other people. And I kind of, through a meandering path, I started reading about aesthetics and thinking about it aesthetically. So in terms of the atrocity aesthetic, I use the term aesthetic kind of in two main ways. Like, the first is a kind of sensory paradigmatic model, right? Like, a cubist aesthetic is a particular, you have to conform to it if you're going to do something in a cubist style, right? So describe this kind of cluster of sensory experiences we associate with a certain category of things, right? So that's one way. And then also, I think about it, I was reading some of the work of Jacques Rancière, a French theorist who is very French, so not a lot of footnotes and not a lot of explanation, but the one thing that did strike me was describing the aesthetics as the partition of the sensible, in terms of the kind of social and political processes through which what is understandable or legible is determined within a given society or grouping or whatnot. And so I kind of was thinking about those. And I came up with what I thought was the kind of, I started trying to describe what I thought the paradigmatic aesthetic of an atrocity is. And so the basic notion, when I refer to the atrocity aesthetic, is a notion that there exists, I argue, this kind of dominant yet often unstated kind of shared understanding, both among kind of actors loosely defined within international criminal justice and transitional justice worlds, but also the wider public, of both atrocity and international crime. And that notion and understanding is associated deeply with spectacular acts of horrific violence and abuse, that kind of, when we are exposed to, typically visually, but also in other ways, elicit this kind of visceral reaction that this is horrible, this is bad, this is wrong, this is the worst of the worst. And so it's a very visceral aesthetic, grounded in spectacular acts of horrific violence. And I think that shapes assumptions concerning how genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes can and will manifest themselves and the means through which they can be committed. So I know that was a bit rambly, but I think I might have answered multiple questions, including some you didn't ask.
That's great. So there's a couple things I was thinking of related to this. I actually did ask Alex Hinton how central the crime of genocide was to the actual implementation of the Khmer Rouge Tribunal or the Khmer Tribunal. I know there was other physical integrity violations, there's torture. Do you think genocide was, the charge of genocide was central to there being a tribunal? And I ask this for two reasons. One, I'm curious because, we can think about the different atrocity crimes and, whether there maybe is even a hierarchy among the atrocity crimes, but also, you described famine and also the intentions behind the acts that led to people starving. And, genocide includes deliberately causing conditions that do not facilitate life. And, which gets at to another question. And sorry, now I'm asking too many things at once, but, within the atrocity crimes, there are things that do not fit the atrocity aesthetic. And so it's another question again, why doesn't international criminal law necessarily, sort of incorporate the full body of the law when it is approaching these atrocity situations? That was probably too much at once, but did you get everything?
Why don't I take a stab and then you can kind of redirect me as needed.
Okay.
So when it comes to the creation of the court, I think there's always this allure of, what David Sheffer calls the G word, right? Of genocide. the creation of the court. I'm not an expert on the creation of the court. I've read it is a very long and protracted negotiation process over years that I have read about, but I don't pretend to be, you know, a special expert on. I defer to Alex there. But when it comes to the practice of the court, you know, just by necessity, genocide was if you wanted to kind of divvy it up in terms of number of days of hearings, amount of evidence, number, significance in terms of overall percentage of the judgments and number of victims, genocide was very tangential, because it was largely a crimes against humanity court. So, you know, if you think about, you know, it didn't have a lot to do with war crimes, although there were some war crimes because there was these skirmishes with the Vietnamese across the border. But these were not atrocities that took place during any kind of armed conflict, right? And crimes against humanity being a widespread systematic attack against the civilian population. I mean, that really fits the bill for the Khmer Rouge regime's abuse of Cambodians, right? Work camps, abuse, starvation, prisons, all those things, right? So most of the judgments focused on crimes against humanity as the core set of crimes that just kind of fit best. I know there's the endless debate about whether genocide is the crime of crimes. You know, legally, I think it's not really clear that there's any kind of hierarchy, of course, but does that matter, right? If that's all people care about, or if people do think that it's the most important crime, lawyers and other people, there's only so much people can do to disabuse them of that notion, even if they hold it. So it was generally, it was largely a crimes against humanity court. And then when it comes to the kind of potential versus actual kind of scope and application of international criminal law, if I'm kind of interpreting your question correctly, that's kind of what I focus mostly on in the book, right? I know my book can be, and frankly, it has been read as like a kind of call for expansionist call for like expanding international criminal law, coming up with new crimes, you know, adding to the Rome Statute or wherever else, adding to custom. That's not how I envision it. And I tried to be pretty careful with my language in it, is that it is more a call to say, if we have this thing, and to be honest, I remain pretty ambivalent about the existence of international criminal law at all. But if we do have this thing, I think I'm concerned that we're not really exploring all the different ways in which, you know, groups of people can cause mass harm to one another. And we're just really looking at the subset of things that are familiar, that are spectacular, that really make us uncomfortable when we are forced to experience them, look at them, hear them, smell them even. I think that there's often an assumption that the law can't do anything else. And I think there's lots of reasons behind that, which I'm happy to go into some of. But I think, you know, one of them is just that, you know, we have an overabundance of very obvious, very aesthetically and otherwise paradigmatic atrocities that occur every year all the time, that are never prosecuted and many of them never even investigated. So there's not really any kind of internalized pressure within the kind of world of international criminal law to say, oh, where else can we go with the existing law? Because, you know, we're sitting here looking at these obvious crimes that are not being investigated, and especially not punished, right? So I think that there's a kind of structural forces at play there. And then it's going to be harder to kind of pave new, to hoe new ground, right? Why do that when, you know, you can pick any number of situations across the world and say, oh, you know, even from your armchair, even a non-lawyer can be like, that is an atrocity crime, you know, and be right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that just made me think of, you know, I've done some writing on Yemen, and right now I'm working on a paper on you know, coverage of the conflict, comparing the coverage of the conflict in Yemen to that in Ukraine. And you know, I was just writing the backgrounder, and you know, you have all these, you know, these eminent experts and Human Rights Council, other things, calling war crimes in Yemen, and you know, they're repeated, so they're certainly verging on, if not certainly systematic, but there will be no accountability. So just thinking of one example of where it's, you know, if we want to have international criminal law be getting into other things like famine crimes, and I think they're already not holding those accountable for these very, what's the word I'm looking for here? Very visible atrocity crimes that we all know are happening. So yeah, I guess maybe
just quickly comment on that.
Sure.
Yeah, because I know folks at places like Global Rights Compliance, which is a great law firm and NGO, you know, have been working on Yemen issues, and they're really frustrated. they've been working on them for years, and I know some of the people there, and one of the reasons we've discussed is, you know, starvation and famine is one of the biggest killers in Yemen. And once the war the most active part of the war turned into smaller skirmishes, and a lot more of the suffering was due to deprivation and starvation and famine, you know, it kind of dropped off the radar to a large extent. And that includes, I think, kind of prospects for accountability. So I'm not saying I'm right all the time, but I think, you know, in those discussions that really came through to me, and I'd be interested to hear what you think about it. I'm sure you know far more about Yemen, I have not been kind of diving into that for a couple of years, about that dynamic, right? So there does seem to be a kind of, you know, you talk about the attention economy, you talk about, you know, Paul Slovic and psychic numbing and things like that. There seem to be these forces at work. And I don't pretend that, you know, aesthetics is the only one that really kind of calibrate when and how we pay attention, that have nothing to do with kind of like relative assessments of gravity or importance, as fraught as, you know, trying to make those comparisons are in the first place.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Well, you know, I think, you know, with what I'm working on now on media coverage, you can see, you know, the drop off in media coverage, and, you know, specifically the New York Times coverage of Yemen. And of course, you know, there's other things happening too, right? There's competition, right? So there's the next visible atrocity, and there's, of course, geopolitics and other things as well. Like, I'm not surprised that In the first 2 months of the New York Times coverage of Ukraine, it has exceeded the coverage of Yemen over 7 years. That doesn't really surprise me, but so I don't want to say that there's a causal effect here, but I do see, I can say that where the New York Times coverage of Yemen did drop off also seems to be when, like you said, when the sort of nature of the conflict had transitioned. And so it's, which also, I guess maybe a question I would have, back to you then is maybe twofold, and you might not, I don't know if you'll be able to answer the first one, but, does the media contribute to maintaining an atrocity, aesthetic? And also does international criminal law contribute to, the atrocity aesthetic?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't want to dodge your question too much. So on one level, I would say yes to almost any kind of grouping or category you would say, because I think, at heart, a lot of my book is grounded in social constructivism and, things are made and remade all the time through social interactions according to that. And I do believe that to be true. So I think we all kind of more or less may wittingly or otherwise kind of peddle in or fall into these processes because it's an easy way of recognizing atrocities, right? If we care about atrocity. So I do think the media, of course, is involved. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily them, sitting around saying, here's a great picture of a really awful, dead body. Let's run that. Let's background this other one of a person in the process of starving or whatever it is. Or even something that's much more neutral about a new citizenship law passed in Myanmar that we know is going to cause mass harm, but hasn't yet. Right. Things like that. So I don't think they're out there. I hope they're not out there actively doing that, but I think the media, and especially with the increased kind of defunding of public news and the kind of privatization of news, of course market forces are at play and they are needing to sell paper and get eyes, and this is one way of doing it, right? Susan Sontag wrote about that quite a while ago, among many other people. And I think when it comes to international criminal law, one of the things I think in the book that was kind of surprising to me is that I think that the inherent structure of international criminal law as a kind of Western, criminal law based structure, which requires individual culpability and, a fair amount of causation or at least contribution to causation that's pretty direct, being inherently limiting, right? I think, I went in thinking that it's the inherent limitations of the law, especially criminal law. And I came out thinking, a lot of international criminal law, at least to me, remains pretty nascent, given the dearth of prosecutions that we have we don't know exactly what every provision of every component of every international crime, exactly where it ends, exactly where modes of liability, which is a whole other arena, which is the mechanisms legally through which individuals are held responsible for what are invariably large-scale group crimes, like how far they can reach. There's outer frontier of international criminal law that is unexplored, and I don't know exactly what the boundaries are. I think there's lots of debate to be had about where they are, where they should be, but I just feel like it's not explored, and I think that kind of makes international criminal law somewhat complicit in terms of, it has its structural limitations and it can't really, as a neutral kind of just a thing, right, be blamed for that, but the failure to kind of figure out what it can't do, I think, is really important because we focus on it first and foremost. And I don't think that's a good idea, but I do think that's what happens, right?
Yeah. I was thinking also about, you know, activists and human rights organizations, you mentioned the word complicit, and I don't want to make activists complicit, but you know, there's of course been lots of research on, I'm in genocide studies, right? So there's a lot of research on the use and misuse of the term genocide, the use of the term genocide sort of sensationally to draw, you know, not with ill intention, but rather to draw attention to whether it's genocide or not, to the plight that, you know, that groups or individuals are facing. And so I wonder, you know, do advocates and advocates, human rights organizations, do they also contribute to the aesthetic through their, you know, engagement on social media, through the photographs that maybe they use to draw attention to their situation, you know, in their human rights reports and what they focus on in human rights reports? You know, there's for a long time, Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International did receive some criticism because they focused more on civil and political rights versus economic and social rights. And so has all of this also contributed to the atrocity aesthetic?
I think yes. And I'll qualify that. So, I mean, I think there's two dynamics going on and two kind of separate debates, right? There's first these debates about, well, some organizations are calling, you know, X, Y, or Z a genocide, and it is, you know, kind of manifestly in terms of human suffering, if you want to take an anthropocentric view, but however you want to measure it, like of a lesser magnitude than what genocide, at least legally, is, right? So something that is manifestly not a genocide, just let's get the cachet of genocide by throwing that word out there and being provocative. I think that can sometimes be a little bit irresponsible. If potentially, depending on the cause, you know, coming from a good place. I think, you know, that is not really contributing so much. What is, and I don't know, like I would not use the word complicit here, is I think that activists are under this kind of pressure and tension, right? We live in this attention economy. These NGOs are also, unfortunately, almost all donor-based, like they rely on donors for all of their funding, and how they get donor attention is by getting broader public attention, right? So they're in the business of getting attention, and they're fighting for attention and resources. And if they decide that this is problematic and they're going to, you know, focus on structural justice issues, they're going to refuse to reproduce these things, it can come with some real cost to them, right? And they can just, if they fade into obscurity, does that really help things? Like, I don't know, right? I think those are difficult questions. And I do think some of the more thoughtful and responsible actors in this world, I'm sure, have these debates like within their staff, right? And how are we going to go about this? How are we going to responsibly represent these things? How are we going to try to get the issues we think are important up there? I mean, courts do this as well, right? So there's a wonderful book by Christine Schwoble Patel called Marketing Global Justice. She talks about how the ICC itself engages in kind of marketing practices, but also almost like in itself, knowingly or not, kind of incorporates marketing logic into how it operates and how it presents itself, talking about kind of return on investment and things like that. So I think it's very complicated, but I also think that it operates, the aesthetic operates to constrain activists and civil society organizations from the other end, right? So what really stuck in my mind was I did some grant writing, right? And there was a particular grant, I think it was by USAID, but it could have been by kind of any organization, major grant funder. And it was for something like, you know, post-atrocity, transitional justice work, human rights in the wake of atrocity, those kinds of things. I can't remember the exact language. And it was a worldwide call for applications, right? And it was for countries dealing with the legacies of atrocity violence and mass human rights violations. And, you know, it said, these are the countries, and they had a list that we define as being in that space, right? And so it was predictable countries. Cambodia was among them, right? Colombia, other places that are kind of, you know, we would think of. But you could imagine, what if you're in another place where, you know, there's been this slow burning oppression and violence that maybe has involved arguably international crimes, and you can't even apply for this funding to do this work. I think that's also a component that, I mean, is perhaps more troubling to me, of just kind of leaving people out of the conversation to start with.
Yeah. So I'll ask you one more. Does this contribute to the atrocity aesthetic question? And then we'll move on. You know, I have an edited volume on cultural genocide, and you know, you mentioned cultural genocide early on in your book, and it made me think about you know, cultural genocide and how it doesn't fit the atrocity aesthetic. And you talk about this a little later in your book, and you know, in the intro to my edited volume, I share a concern that cultural, you know, putting culture before genocide, you know, sort of presents it as something less than or other than just plain genocide. And, you know, you share this concern in your book as well. And I suppose, you know, the question would be, have I contributed to it? Because even though I address it in the introduction, I nonetheless have a book called Cultural Genocide. A cultural genocide is probably used 1,000 times between all the authors. And, you know, not just me, but do academics also contribute to the atrocity aesthetic through our research, through our engagement, maybe in public discourse? And are there ways around or ways to avoid doing that, even when you're trying to do something important or good, or, you know, whatever value you want to attach to it?
Yeah. So, I'll let you off the hook. So actually I've thought about this. So I'm from this, where this comes up a lot amongst other places is in the context of Canada, which is actually where I grew up. I grew up in Ontario. And, you know, this whole kind of never-ending debate against what happened and arguably is continuing to happen to Indigenous populations in the territory that is now defined as Canada, right? And, you know, settler colonialism, and was that a kind of genocidal process? I will argue all day to you that it obviously was, and it's a joke to say that it wasn't. And I would also argue that it's probably, settler colonial genocides have been among the most successful in terms of just taking what they wanted and then keeping it. But, you know, there's this whole cultural genocide component, right, that floats around. And some people will say it wasn't a genocide, and then they'll say, sure, it was if you want to say cultural genocide, but then they'll say that's not a legal genocide and that's not a real genocide. And then that debate also goes on within genocide studies itself, which is kind of multidisciplinary. And honestly, as a legal scholar, I'm often the kind of one people don't want to talk to because we're the most annoying, thinking that we own definitions, right? Which is not what I think, but I do see that. and so to me, what's really put this into stark relief has been the recent exhumations of bodies of children murdered at residential schools, at sites adjacent to former residential schools in Canada, and how this has caused, you know, perhaps the millionth, quote, reckoning of Canada's dark history, right? Which, in my view, is not really a reckoning because we haven't done anything much about it. But then now that has made the kind of atrocity real to a lot of people in Canada. And it's increasingly happening where the residential schools, it's almost like in attempts to sanitize Canada's history, the residential schools have become a kind of cancer that needs to be excised. But it also needs to be disaggregated from everything else that was happening and intimately connected with the residential schools, such as, for example, the mass removal of Indigenous children through child welfare practices and policies, which is talked about much less. And so I think, you know, there is accurate descriptive value in a term like cultural genocide, but often it is deployed, in my view, irresponsibly as a way of designating something as not a real, i.e. legal genocide, when for me, in many contexts, and I'm thinking specifically about Canada's right now, what people describe as cultural genocide was merely just one component of a larger traditional classical genocidal process that was long-term and multifaceted, right? And so there's this kind of process. So it's like once you can't deny, right? Once genocide denial or atrocity denial is impossible for everything, e.g. residential schools and what happened there, then it becomes this, like, you'd think, okay, well, now let's have a full reckoning. Let's look at everything. Instead, what seems to happen is, okay, next we're going to kind of disaggregate and disattach and then look at select things, and then still ignore the rest, right? And I view the rest as being, you know, like child removals, other things like that, as the kind of interstitial material that binds together the kind of eruptions of more traditional forms of violence, and that you can't really understand it if you don't look at all of it together. I know that's a little bit rambly, but it's something I've been thinking about recently, so it's kind of partially formed. And I actually have a student, her name is Alyssa Cucci, who has written, she's a member of the Nipissing First Nation, who somehow found her way to Hawaii for law school, and wrote a wonderful paper talking about this connection between residential schools and child removals that should be forthcoming in the Michigan Journal of International Law in the next year or so. So I encourage everyone to look at that for a much better articulation of kind of the rambling thoughts, because her and I have kind of talked about this a fair amount as two Canadians, and especially with her particularized lived experience.
Thanks, Randall. I don't think I was planning on asking you this when we started, but since you've been thinking about this topic, and maybe this also plays into, you know, the constructivism, what role did the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada play, and for who? I don't know if you want to take a stab at that, even though we probably weren't planning
question.
On it.
Yeah, so the TRC in Canada, I mean, it's big, it's long, the report is thousands of pages. I can't pretend that I've read every bit of it. I've looked at it many times. I'm still trying to figure that out. Because a lot of what's in it is really interesting and is a really progressive interpretation of things like genocide and discussion of connections, including there's a part about child removals in there. And so I think in some ways it was kind of a model, but then what has come out of that is not a lot of kind of action. And there's all the calls to action. And then famously, Prime Minister Trudeau years ago, part of his platform in getting elected was saying he's going to implement all of the calls to action. And then predictably kind of the low-hanging fruit of like honorary stuff, you know, public apologies has been implemented, but the hard structural stuff, the stuff that's going to involve sustained consultation, long-term processes of repair and redress, doesn't really seem to have got much momentum. And also, I think it's important to remember how the TRC came about. My kind of pessimistic position is that, you know, the government likes to pretend that it was some kind of like voluntary thing that they grew a conscience and decided it was time to address this history. But there were, this is where the law comes back in, there were numerous individual lawsuits being brought by survivors of residential schools, and for various legal reasons we can go into if you want, these were not time-barred tort actions because of the nature of the violations, and individuals were winning large settlements based on the abuse they suffered from the Canadian government. And then a couple classes were formed where class action lawsuits were coming with potential billions or even trillions of dollars of liability for the Canadian government. At this point, there was a negotiated settlement of these class action lawsuits, which involved the creation of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So in one way, you could frame it as a kind of money saving exercise, if you want to be really kind of pessimistic about it. I think it was many things, and many people who had very good intentions were involved, and I think it did do some interesting things, but I think it's a complicated beast, and I'm still not sure. I don't pretend to be expert enough to really have a strong opinion about it, although I would feel better if more of the calls to action seemed to have really spurred actual action.
Yeah, I definitely am of a bit of a cynic, and so I suppose I wouldn't be surprised. I'm not surprised by what you said. I don't know if this also connects to the Truth and Reconciliation in Canada, but when dealing with invisible atrocities, or I should maybe say with dealing with atrocities in general. For like war crimes and genocide, we have the planners, we have the perpetrators. There's usually someone that blame can be assigned to. When dealing with invisible atrocities, is the sort of gray area around what's the specific guilty act, who's the responsible party, what's the, can we prove some form of criminal intent? Do these elements or variables contribute to the invisibility of some atrocities?
I think they do, but I think they do in a way that is different than is commonly assumed. And I'll try to explain that. So, there are lots of kind of structural injustices which, in an oversimplified way, no one is kind of criminally culpably responsible for, because we are all complicit in some way, right? Talking about kind of global inequality and poverty and things like that. There are people that can be blamed for parts of this, of course. I don't want to pretend that there's not some very nefarious people out there profiteering off these. But in a general sense, there's these kind of structural injustices, right? However, I try to point out in the book, there are other instances where the directness of causation may be there, but the kind of modality of harm causation and what the actual guilty acts of individuals are both so unfamiliar that it's easy to just assume that there is no culpability, right? So to kind of make that more concrete, when you think about something like the Khmer Rouge era famine or other famines, right? There are policies put in place by a group of people, and in the Khmer Rouge context, enforced with incredibly brutal repercussions for anyone who deviates, that directly start to cause mass famine. The leadership is simultaneously obsessed with rice production, which is the primary form of food, source of food, throughout the countryside, and already was before they took power. They see that people are starving. They're taking way too much food because that's their only currency. They're doing it through all these bureaucratic processes that don't look like violence, for lack of a better word. They are doing so at meetings. They're doing so through enactments, right? And these are not what we think of as like guilty acts, but then they're finding out people are dying, and then they're choosing to just keep doing the same thing, well and full aware that there's a massive human cost involved, right? And that's just one context. But I think often these kinds of slow, attritive forms of violence are perpetrated by incredibly powerful actors, often those associated with the state, because they have the ability to kind of control the everyday intimate aspects of people's lives. You know, to think of it, I was thinking of like biopolitics, of just like, you know, they can disallow life if they want through bureaucratic means, right? So it can often be very bureaucratic and slow. And yet, if they know what they're doing and they're not merely just letting it happen, but they're causing it, seeing it happen, then maybe they started off as negligent or non-culpable, but at some point they're continuing to support policies and processes that are very directly causing harm on a very massive scale, and they are well aware of this. And that is the moment that I try to identify in the book and say, hey, we should be looking at that, because that actually fits quite well in a criminal law paradigm, but it doesn't look familiar, and it may lead us to people that we don't associate as being the kind of, you know, evil masterminds who are out bloodthirsty and out to kill that perpetrators of international crimes are associated with, often stereotyped as. So that's kind of how I see that playing out. But I don't want to overstate the reach of international criminal law. There's tons of awful stuff that that body of law should not and cannot address, and is incredibly important. And we should be spending a lot of time and energy and resources to address.
And would, you know, I was thinking about what you said, you know, the perpetrators or the responsible actors might not look like we typically assume that they do. If invisible atrocities were sort of brought more to the foreground, would this potentially, I mean, you talked about Canada already, but would this implicate global North states in ways that we don't typically sort of see or understand global North states?
I think partially. I mean, I think it would often implicate kind of generally powerful actors. They can be powerful regionally. They can be powerful globally. People with the ability to kind of control the lives, you know, socioeconomically, in various ways, of groups of people. And I think those are the kinds of people that they have at their disposal, various means that they can choose to use to cause mass harm, right? They have a military they can order out to kill these people, or they can, you know, if you think about like the situation of Rohingya people in Myanmar for decades before anyone really cared about it as an atrocity, right? It was stripping citizenship. They couldn't work, couldn't go places, kind of death by a thousand cuts, right? And that's a global South country. But I do think it may often implicate the global North in terms of our reach into other places, right? And even when it comes to traditional atrocities, you know, you think about like in the Canadian context, Canada has a bunch of multinational mining corporations that are actively or passively benefiting from extreme human rights violations all over the world. I mean, mining is a horrific enterprise in many places, right? And of course, the focus is often on the local actors rather than the CEOs and whatnot. And that's nothing new. And I don't think my book, you know, really, if that was the point of my book, I think it'd be a pretty boring book because I think lots of people are well aware of that. But I do think that, and I also think something that's related to that that I've been thinking through recently, so forgive me if this is a little bit convoluted, I was gesturing at a little bit in parts of the book was, well, what does this tell us about what international criminal law actually does? And I think the one thing we can say is that by and large, actors in the global North have an outsized impact on international criminal law, both in terms of its substance and how it is applied and where it is applied and when, right? And I think I'm concerned that maybe one of the things ICL actually is really good at is, you imagine the public, right, turn on their news. There's this famous quote from a famous Canadian case, the Finta case, where one of the justices says, talking about atrocities, you know, every time we turn on our television now, it would probably be Twitter, other things, you know, we are daily assault, our eyes are daily assaulted by images of atrocity, right? Obviously, that's upsetting, especially to us that are want to think of ourselves as good global citizens, as caring about people in other parts of the world. And so when we see that, right, does that, that might create some pressure to carry out prosecutions, because it feels like we're doing something then, and then we can maybe let go. I've toyed with the idea of kind of catharsis, right? We might be able to let go of some of that. And that's part of what I'm concerned with. I think maybe international criminal law is actually good at that. If it may not be so good at repressing atrocity, it may be good at kind of letting us feel a little better, because we feel like we see this bad thing, and then if we support the prosecutions, then they happen, and we see this person in jail, then we feel like we've done something, and then we feel less harmed ourselves by seeing these really awful images. And that makes me uncomfortable, because it's almost like viewers in distant places, often in the global north, is a kind of like quasi-secondary class of victims, which I think is problematic on various fronts.
Well, on that note, I'll wrap us up. And you know, you said this is something you've been thinking about, and something I like to ask the people I interview as we close is there something that you're currently working on? So you've been thinking about this. Is this something that you intend to do further research, writing, publications on? And is there anything else that you're currently working on?
Yeah, so I am trying to think through that. I'm supposed to be writing up that as something along those lines, like ugly atrocities, cathartic prosecutions is kind of the working title for a chapter for an edited volume to be put out by Mark Drumble and Carolyn Fournet on the aesthetics of international criminal law. I went to a workshop last year in the UK where we, you know, lots of people were talking about different aspects of this. So I'm supposed to be writing that up. I'm, of course, behind. And then the other thing that this has made me think about is I teach criminal law. And so I'm always have this tension. Yeah, I research international criminal law, and I'm kind of ambivalent about that, but I'm more and more erring towards abolition in the US context because of, you know, many, we don't have time to go into all the problems of the US criminal justice system. And clearly it shows me that more is not always better when it comes to criminal law. But also I think it's reached such an extreme amount of harm being caused by mass incarceration, racialized mass incarceration in the US, and the awful conditions of confinement. I think of a phrase, I think it was Christina Sharp who describes it as violence as care, what we do to inmates. So I've been thinking through a project called American Carceral Atrocities, where I think through whether international criminal law might have something to say about the U.S. system of racialized mass incarceration and what that might mean for mass incarceration, but also what it might mean for international criminal law. Is this a non-criminal atrocity? Is it like, what is this system? Because there's millions of people being harmed, and it's, some of the harms are quite extreme. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about right now, but that's kind of my fantasy project that I've been thinking about, perhaps not working on as much as I would like, but it's just always in my mind.
That sounds great, Randall. Thank you so much for your time. And I look forward to reading more of your work as it comes out, and you know, take care.
All right. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. This has been really, really great. And also, by the way, I'm an avid listener, so thanks for your work as well. It really helps me kind of put things on my radar, and I've really found some great things, and I enjoy the podcast. So keep it up.
Thank you, Randall.